Hello, this is Stuart Molina. I know I haven't podcast for a while, but with the opening of our new season, I thought it would be a good idea to get back into the swing of this. Today we'll be talking about Handsome's Second Symphony. The Romantic Symphony was written in 1932 by Howard Handsome, American composer, not just known as a great composer, but also as a great educator, having been the director of the Eastman School of Music up in Rochester, New York, and having built that institution into the great music conservatory that it is today. Handsome was also an enormous champion of new music and went through a process of recording many of the great works of the early part of the 20th century by other amazing American composers, his own music, Harris's music, I could go on. But we owe a great debt of thanks to Howard Handsome for exposing us to this great music and also for some of the beautiful music that he wrote himself. Howard Handsome rejected the direction that music was going in at the beginning of the 20th century, the total departure from a harmonic language, 12-tone music, certainly he never participated in. He very much sat within the Romantic period, even though he did expand somewhat his harmonic language from what you would get from composers like Brahms, Tchaikovsky, and even Mahler. The Romantic Symphony is called Romantic, not so much because it's a piece of romance like you'd find in the movies or in a romance novel, but rather romantic in the sense that it's music that has affect, music that brings across an emotion. There are moments of great lushness. There are also moments of great starkness. But the idea of romantic as a title indicates Handsome's proclivity towards writing music with melody, writing music with a harmonic progression, writing music that's understandable by an audience, and that even might provoke a reaction in an audience of saying, ah, or humming a melody as they leave the concert hall. And this is one of the reasons that this piece is so popular among concert goers and audiences, because it is so accessible from the very beginning to the end. It has a nice arch and very beautiful melodies, and melodies that come throughout the piece. It's a cyclical piece. You have material at the very beginning and in the second theme of the first movement that we'll hear in each of the other movements. So what is this piece about harmonically? Well, in my mind, Handsome sets up this piece as a contrast between polytonality, meaning multiple chords on top of each other, and simple tonality. At the very beginning, the first chords you hear are combinations of two different triads, two different chords. The G major chord, which is G, B, and D, and the D flat major chord, D flat, F, and A flat. These two chords are one tritone apart. If you take an octave, meaning the same note in different registers, and divide that octave exactly in half, you get a tritone. This was called the devil in music hundreds of years ago, and for a long time it was prohibited to be heard, that it was considered an evil interval. Of course, we've progressed past that in the last several centuries. The tritone is as common as anything else, but to put two chords together, a tritone apart, is really taking the two furthest extremes of harmony and combining them. And what does it sound like? Well, the first chord is a G major chord, or at least the most important part of a G major chord, the G and the B, which defines the major key, and then the D flat chord on top of it. The melody that he gives this opening is a simple third, with the scale in between. This becomes one of the germs, one of the little musical tidbits that he's going to base all the material of the piece on. And in the harmony, As I said, he starts with the G on the bottom, the D flat on top. But when he gets to the last note of this melody, he switches and puts the G major on top and the D flat on the bottom. So, listen again to this opening measure. Combination of two chords, one tritone apart from each other, and then switching, putting the one that's on the bottom on the top. And with all of this, a very, very simple melodic motive. The opening section will take this harmonic progression and melodic motive and repeat it again and again and again, building an intensity through orchestration, adding instruments, adding a pulse in the timpani, which will get more intense, building in dynamics. As more instruments come in, it gets louder and louder and louder, and also building in register, starting in this very middle area and moving up to the further extremes sonically, both lower and higher. So over the course of 12 rather ponderous bars, we build in intensity, and then with a cymbal explosion, we reach the top, and then he brings it back down, and we get a reverse motive coming downhill, and he does this in half the time. So we've set up this polytonal world of G and D flat together, and I feel that throughout this piece, what he's going to do is bring this back as the tension part of the piece, and then relax into a very tonal world, a completely recognizable, rather lush and emotional in its melodic and harmonic content. I'm not going to cover everything in the piece, but you're going to hear a lot of variations on that opening. Shortly after the beginning, you'll hear a section that's much quicker with our chord that we heard at the beginning as the underpinning of a new melody, which we'll hear first in the horns. So, what makes up this melody? Well, we have our minor third descending. This is outlining our D flat chord, but with the G in there, which wouldn't be part of a D flat major scale, you'd hear. But we have, again, reminding us of the D with the G underneath it. And then he continues by bringing in a B natural in the melody. So he's actually written a melody that goes along very nicely with our harmony. Every note in his melody is part of those two chords. So this section goes on for a while. We have kind of a canonic expression of this new melody in various instruments. And then, after, again, a climax, he brings it back down and we have our first tonal moment, now in the key of B-flat, with a new melody, which we hear first in the oboe. And this is harmonized in B-flat, with the addition of the second degree of the scale, which gives it almost a slightly jazzy, perhaps, certainly a warm, emotional element to it. This will progress in a rather emotional way, but the idea of this section, again, is a contrast to our opening. Our opening was in this polytonal, stress-filled musical world, and here it's like an ah moment, where we can exhale and have a simple melody with individual wind players playing, with a harmonization underneath. Very lush, very beautiful. He'll bring back a reminder at the end of this section of our original moment. Our opening D flat over G. And then a very short transition. Which is kind of in this in-between harmonic world. Not quite as harmonically grating as the beginning, certainly not as harmonically simple as the second theme. And then he brings us to the most famous part of this piece, which is our main second subject. And it's an E-flat major, and there are two elements. One is a melody, which we hear in the strings at first. Using again his third, like we had at the beginning, and harmonized again with that beautiful major second chord. Again, very much in a popular style, almost like a popular song, with a very simple melody. Now, on top of this, we have a counter melody in the French horn, a solo French horn. Etc. Together, they make a very beautiful texture. And we're going to hear both of these melodies at certain points throughout the piece, reminding us of this first step into a different kind of world with this beautiful, romantic, expressive section. There is a development section in this piece, and it'll take us into various other harmonic worlds. We'll hear chords which are called sharp nine chords. The idea of a sharp nine chord is you have a normal seventh chord with the addition of the minor third on top. So you have that conflict of a major third and a minor third. Similar to the beginning, but much more of a piece than our complex chord that we had at the very beginning of the piece. And against this, you'll have a simple melody that we heard before. Theme that we heard right after the opening in that first quick section. Then this will change, and from he raises the major third up a step, and we have a fourth with another fourth on top, and we'll have a long, very smooth section with that as the harmonic basis. And we'll hear a very simple melody on top of it, which indeed is the same melody that we heard at the beginning, but now much more lyrically. So what he's doing is combining these various elements, creating new sound textures, new harmonic language, but it will always come back to, at some point, to our G underneath D flat. And indeed, the development section ends with a return to that and our recapitulation, and we hear all of the material one more time reiterated. At the end of this movement, after we've had the big return to the lush, famous melody, he gives us a little bit of a coda, a closing section. The melody itself ends, quoted that many times. In the closing section, he expands that. And so at the very end, we hear... kind of this striving addition from D flat to E major, and then back down. Then we hear it again in the oboes. Then we hear it in the rest of the woodwinds, but now with an ominous seventh underneath. And then in the strings. And they end on D flat. We hear it again. Then we have it stretched out even more in the horns, and he surprises us with the third chord. And lets that hang for a while, some silence. And the low strings give us a D flat major. So again, he ends with tension and release. The second movement begins with yet another melody that's recognizable by concert goers. Now we're in C major, and he starts in the beautiful world of very simple C major harmony. It's very beautiful, very simple, at the same time extremely tender, with a warm string underpinning. And we'll hear this melody a few times, and he'll vary it slightly, but generally it stays within the world of C major, a little bit of a departure to E minor, but nothing harmonically out of the ordinary at all. And when I say ordinary, I mean like 19th century ordinary. But then it's not enough to be in this very simple harmonic world. He's going to bring us back into our weird polytonal world. And we have at the end of this opening section... the horns play in C... the timpani plays A flat. Then the trumpet and trombone. We're back to our opening chord from the first movement. So we've started in this movement, instead of starting with the complex harmony and resolving it, we start with the simple harmony and move back into a complex harmony world. And he stays there for a while. There are little explosions from the woodwind section, which sparkle a little bit, but are still within this strange... is it a minor chord, or is it two chords on top of each other? And we'll return to our melody, and then back to the woodwinds. And then we have a big buildup of our original chords again. And, you know, you've heard it many times. You know that it's building like the opening section of the first movement, but this time it immediately resolves into our big tonal theme. But this time we do not hear the main melody, which was... we just hear the counter melody now as the main melody. Played very grandly in the horns. works very well on its own. We remember it. It doesn't necessarily make a complete connection because we've only heard it as a secondary theme thus far. But the moment the harmony is instantly recognizable as what we had in the first movement, again, I say it's a cyclical piece. It keeps us interested in the piece as a whole when each of these movements comes back to material that we had in the opening movement. So this will go on. We have this very dramatic middle section. It will then calm down once again. We'll have a restatement of the opening theme. This time he ends absolutely in C major. None of that strange tension right before the end. This time he just gives us C major again. And whereas the horns in the first movement gave us a strange departure, here they just reiterate C major. So if you see the first movement as tension, release, tension, release, and at the end, tension, release, this is very much simple harmony, tension, big release, tension, and then again the simple harmony. So he's reversed his direction in a certain sense in the second movement. In the third movement, he again begins very much in C major, but this time with a very different feeling. The second movement was tender. This one is exciting. Allegro con brio. Allegro with a lot of sparkle, a lot of life. This is what this opening will sound like. With the strings and the woodwinds playing this kind of explosive, sparkling accompaniment figure, and then he brings in the horns. C major. And then our fourth on top of fourth, which we had in the first movement. This time it just resolves right back into C major. This fanfare opening lasts for a while. It's then transformed into a different kind of feeling when the basses take over. Etc. Then suddenly things take off again. This last movement almost sounds like one big drive to the finish. There is one other departure that we do get, one rather slow section with an expressive theme, but right away from the beginning, we get this, what's called a 13 chord, or it's a D-flat major chord over an E-flat bass, which is a chord of expectation. Very much along the lines of a Broadway kind of approach, and we get the horns again with a melody. So these chords after chords, building us, driving us forward, back to our explosive opening material, and then into this strange middle section. I say strange just because of the contrast to the sparkling Broadway-type opening. Here we have, again, a return to the fourths. But now he adds two more fourths underneath. So we have four altogether as the beginning of our accompaniment figure. And out of this emerges a beautiful melody in the cello. Continued in a very grand fashion. Again, a very romantic melody, very dramatic in its harmonization. And then at the end of this, we get a return just for a moment to our second movement theme. Just bringing us back into that world, keeping the piece cyclical, we wind down to nothing, and then our true drive to the climax begins. And it begins with pizzicato in the strings, in a low register, with accents thrown in at arbitrary spots. Clearly, it's a tribute or an homage or at least a hearkening to the world of Stravinsky and the Rite of Spring in the second movement of that, where you had... But here, it's in Hansen's own rather tonal world in the key of C major. On top of this pulsation in the low string pizzicato, we have a horn fanfare. And this will continue for a while. The horns will be taken over by the trombones and then the trumpets. The string pizzicato will become string played with the bow in a louder fashion with more accents. We'll get more fanfares. And then this will explode into the next section of our drive, which brings back the material from the second movement, but now as a fanfare. And then the woodwinds take over with the horns, and then the trumpets again. And we have that for a little while. And that brings us to the next section of our fanfare, which brings us back to the world of the first movement. That major theme that we heard right after the opening of the first movement. And this will continue for quite a while, again in canon, with our same opening harmony underneath all the time. In various keys, and then finally our big finish comes where this harmonic tension reaches an exploding point, and it again explodes into our major romantic theme, this time for the entire orchestra, and this time again with just the second part of the theme, but we will get the first part of our theme as well. So this is how that final end will sound. Lush, very beautiful restatement of our melody. Then everything stops, right at the climax, complete silence, and we get just the tag. And Hansen will use those two measures to have, again, another build towards yet another climax. Needless to say, we end in a major key. It is a romantic symphony after all, in the key of D flat major, with a large brass statement of our melody from the second movement, but this time in a different harmonization using entirely major chords. But you'll hear it has a sense of return to our world of multi-harmonies, multi-tonalities. major chord. I really feel this is one of the underrated gems of the 20th century. Some people dismiss it because of its harmonic simplicity, because it doesn't move into new territories of harmony and melody and rhythm. I think quite the opposite. I think it's a masterpiece in that it dwells very solidly in the 20th century. This piece could not have been written in the 19th century, but it's a wonderful rebellion against some of the dissonances that had become standard in the 20th century. And it's a piece that speaks very directly and very effectively to its audience. And I think it's very nice every so often to have a smile kind of piece as opposed to a frown. Even in a dark world, this was written, as I say, in the 1930s. And in the 1930s, there was a lot going on in the world, going on in the country, that was problematic. And this was the kind of piece that people could go to the concert hall and escape. And I think escape is one very nice use of the concert experience. So for now, farewell, and thank you for listening.